An update now on pro basketball's shorter-than-usual season. Thanks to a labor dispute between owners and players, the National Basketball Association began play almost 2 months late. But the NBA didn't trim its schedule nearly as much, which means teams are playing a lot of games in not a lot of time. Sports writer Stefan Fatsis joins us now, as he does most Fridays. Hi there, Stefan.
Hey, Audie.
So just how compressed is this year's schedule?
Well, normally NBA teams play 82 games apiece over 170 days, and that works out to about a game every two-plus days. And at that pace, teams this season should be playing 57 games, but the NBA's owners and players needed to maximize revenue during the shortened season, so they decided to cram in 66 games. It may not sound like a huge difference, but it really is. Every team has to play on three straight nights at least once. You're going to see stretches of five games in six nights, nine games in 12 nights. And for the players, the routine pounding of basketball plus the travel is going to be physically brutal, and it's already having some effects.
In what ways? Where are you seeing it? On the court or off the court?
I think you're going to see it in both places. A lot of these games are going to be a little raggy because you're going to get a lot of bench players playing. Players are going to be called up to fill in for injured players. And that's what we're seeing already. About two-thirds of the league's 30 teams have had key players sit out games with injuries. LeBron James, Dwayne Wade of the Miami Heat, both watched a game from the sidelines last week. Derrick Rose of Chicago, Stephen Curry of Golden State, Carmelo Anthony of New York. The list goes on. Big-name players are getting hurt on a daily basis. To combat this wear and tear because of the schedule, teams are practicing less. They're going to rest important players more. But there's going to be pressure on these guys to come back sooner than maybe they should, because if you miss 10 days, you're going to miss a tenth of the season.
So does this help out the younger players or the more experienced players?
Well, normally experience counts for a lot in the NBA. Last year, the oldest teams, Dallas, Boston, Los Angeles, San Antonio, they all did well. Dallas won its first title. The thinking this year is that the compressed schedule is going to be especially burdensome for these older teams, though. The website Hoopism is doing a season-long study of how teams are faring based on age. And so far, the older teams are doing better than the younger teams overall, but we're only about 10 or 12 games into the season. There are some interesting data points, though. The two oldest teams in terms of age based on minutes that their players play are Dallas and Boston. They're off to very slow starts. Two of the youngest teams, Philadelphia and Oklahoma City, are off to great starts. It'll be interesting to see how this evolves as the season grinds on.
And Stefan, one more thing before I let you go. I want to talk about this article that appeared in Sports Illustrated about Michael Jordan, because it sort of busts a creation myth about him.
Yeah, it's a fantastic piece by Thomas Lake that appears in this week's issue of Sports Illustrated. Throughout Jordan's career, he said that there's only one coach that ever cut him from a team, and it was this guy, Pop Herring. And Thomas Lake goes back and basically debunks this myth. He shows how Jordan, when he was in 10th grade, wasn't cut from the varsity. He didn't make the team. He made the JV instead. There was only one 10th grader on the varsity, and he was on the team because he was much, much taller than Jordan, and they needed size on this team. But much more than taking apart this story that Jordan has told over and over in his career, this is a very sad story about the decline of this coach, Pop Herring, into mental illness at a very, very young age. Thomas Lake tracks him down and tells a very moving story about Michael Jordan's coach.
Stefan Fatsis joins us most Fridays to talk sports. You can hear more of him on Slate Magazine sports podcast Hang Up and Listen. Stefan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Audie.
Now, some companies in need of restructuring become targets for private equity firms. And one private equity firm, Bain Capital, has gotten plenty of attention because Mitt Romney once ran it. NPR's John Itzde evaluates the economic performance of private equity.
Here's what private equity firms like Bain Capital do. First, they go out and find a few large investors, usually pension funds, university endowments, and possibly wealthy individuals. Then, says Ohio State professor Stephen Davidoff, they take that money, borrow a lot more, and buy companies, usually companies that are troubled or undervalued.
and they buy them in the hopes that they can increase the value of the companies and sell them at a fantastic profit.
And Mitt Romney made a fortune doing just that. He also provided big returns for his investors. The problem is that in an effort to make companies more valuable, Romney also shut down factories and cost people jobs. That led one of his opponents, Texas Governor Rick Perry, to suggest Romney was a vulture capitalist.
There's a real difference between venture capitalism and vulture capitalism. Venture capitalism, we like. Vulture capitalism, no.
Another candidate, former Speaker Newt Gingrich, characterized what Romney did at Bain Capital this way.
And those of us who believe that, in fact, the whole goal of investment is entrepreneurship and job creation, would find it pretty hard to justify rich people figuring out clever legal ways to loot a company, leaving behind 1,700 families without a job.
That's ridiculous. Looting a company and destroying a company does not create value.
That's Stephen N. Kaplan. He's a professor at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, and he's an expert on the private equity industry.
At the end of the day, in order to make money, you have to sell the company to somebody. And if the company has been looted and is unproductive, nobody's going to buy it.
The public relations problem for private equity capitalists at firms like Bain Capital, KKR, and Blackstone is that they are the agents of the creative destruction part of capitalism. They aim to take over underperforming firms and operate them more efficiently. Stephen Davidoff, who worked on merger and acquisition deals as a lawyer before becoming a professor at Ohio State, says there's no doubt that in that process, people can get hurt.
Sometimes operating them efficiently means that employees lose their jobs, plants are closed down, and companies are restructured.
But there's no doubt that private equity firms create value. Professor Kaplan says research shows that from 1993 through 2008, money invested in private equity firms produced much higher returns than money invested in the stock market. And remember, that benefited many typical Americans through the public and private pension funds that are big investors in the industry. As for job gains and losses, Professor Kaplan says the direct effects in companies taken over by private equity firms is pretty much a wash.
Employment grows, maybe grows overall a tad less than other companies. And what you conclude from that is that the companies have become more productive.
More productive firms need fewer workers for the same output. Of course, if the underperforming firms had not been taken over, they might have lost lots of jobs because they went out of business. Professor Davidoff says a more valid criticism of private equity firms is that their managers make use of a lucrative loophole to cut their tax bill.
The barons of private equity are probably paying a lower tax rate than their secretaries in terms of percentage.
That's because they structure their compensation in a legal but controversial way so that they pay the capital gains rate of 15% instead of the top rate on ordinary income of 35%. That saved private equity managers billions in tax payments. John Idsty, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Alyssa Block. These days, if you hear a story about a retired pro football player, it's likely about his struggles with injuries sustained years ago on the field. This is not one of those stories. This is the story of what a once great running back does with his life after winning a Heisman Trophy and playing nearly a decade of pro football. In the case of Eddie George, he tackles Shakespeare and Julius Caesar. From member station WPLN in Nashville, Bradley George, no relation to Eddie, has our story.
I hate to spoil it for you, but in Shakespeare's play, Julius Caesar dies really soon. The scene where Marcus Brutus kills Caesar is probably the most famous death scene in all of theater. It's where Julius Caesar utters those famous words, "Et tu, Brute." Despite his early demise, Caesar is a plum role for former Tennessee Titans running back Eddie George.
I was not put on this earth strictly to be a football player, and then that's it, dwindle away. And I have aspirations of being an artist, entertainer, and an actor, and I'm working hard toward that.
George worked hard for 8 seasons with the Titans. He never missed a start, and he played in the Super Bowl. But when he left football, George wanted to try acting, so he set out for Hollywood. George says it was a disaster. He didn't know what he was doing. so he came back to Nashville and sought out an acting coach.
He took me through a boot camp of improv work, of cold readings, of scene study, of character analysis, of all of that. So I really have a gist of what I was doing, a landscape of the theater.
Now, with some performing tools, George has landed some bit parts in a few films and acted in some plays. But he's still a hero to Titans fans. Tens of thousands would watch him play every Sunday. Denise Hicks of the Nashville Shakespeare Festival knows some of those fans will come out to see Julius Caesar because of him. But
he is a really strong actor, really, really strong, and a charismatic stage presence. There is no other actor who could play Caesar the way he could.
George's Caesar sports a bald head and a toga. He looks confident without being cocky. While he's relaxed and soft-spoken offstage, onstage, his voice booms.
Jan Cassius has a lean and hungry look. He thinks too much. Such men are dangerous.
Fear him not, Caesar. He's not dangerous.
Audience member Sherry Lawler isn't a football fan, but she says George has a stage presence that's reminiscent of a famous actor in an iconic role.
It sort of reminds me of Yul Brynner as the King and I.
Eddie George says acting isn't just a hobby for a retired athlete. He says he hopes this production of Julius Caesar will lead to more opportunities to hone his acting chops.
This is not like, hey, you know what? This is cool. I'll put this on my bucket list. You know, I did a Shakespearean piece. Now, this is something that I've worked hard at, that I'm working hard at, and this is just the next thing that presented itself that I have an opportunity to do.
There's plenty more Shakespeare for George to do. There are even plays where the main character doesn't die in the first act. For NPR News, I'm Bradley George in Nashville.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. Penn State President Rodney Erickson has spent the past few days getting grilled by alumni. More than 2 months after a child sex abuse scandal upended the university, alums are angry. But their focus is not so much the alleged crimes. Instead, it's how administrators have dealt with the scandal, specifically their decision to fire longtime football coach Joe Paterno. Last night, Erickson met with Penn State alumni in suburban Philadelphia, and NPR's Jeff Brady was there.
Just days after child sex abuse charges were filed against retired assistant coach Jerry Sandusky, the Board of Trustees fired football coach Joe Paterno and the school president. That's when Rodney Erickson took the helm. Last night in a hotel meeting room before a crowd of about 600 alumni, Erickson laid out an overriding goal for his tenure.
I will not allow this great university and its long and historic legacy as a leader in higher education to be defined by this horrible tragedy.
While a strong statement, that was not one of the applause lines of the evening.
Why did the board fire Joe Paterno prior to conducting an internal investigation?
President Erickson referred questions about Paterno's firing to the Board of Trustees, which issued a statement Thursday. It said trustees unanimously decided letting the coach go was in the best interest of the university. That didn't go over well at another meeting in the same hotel last night. Downstairs, a group of alumni who want to get rid of the entire Board of Trustees held a competing conversation. Former Penn State and pro football player Franco Harris responded to the board's statement that it acted in the best interest of the university.
Do they think that we are that dumb? That's exactly what they said 2 months ago, and they still want us to swallow that.
Harris is a legendary Pittsburgh Steelers running back who played in the 1970s and early 80s. It didn't take long for someone in the audience to suggest he campaign for a seat on Penn State's Board of Trustees.
Okay, now, you know my running days are over.
Back upstairs in the official meeting, 1982 graduate Anthony Lebrano chastised President Erickson for not issuing an apology to former coach Paterno.
You haven't even yet called the man. There has been no one from this university, no one in an administrative capacity, call Coach Paterno. Coach Bill O'Brien called him Monday night, and he's only been with us a couple of days.
Much of the discussion centered on the firing of Paterno and how the scandal has harmed Penn State's reputation. At one point, President Erickson steered the conversation toward the 10 alleged victims.
There are some things that happened here, if true, we need to take responsibility for. If there are victims, by God, we need to do right by them. We need to see that they get justice.
Penn State alumni raised more than $500,000 to help victims of sexual assault in the weeks after the scandal broke. 2 months on, many of them are now focusing their anger on how the school's leadership treated Joe Paterno. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Philadelphia.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Alyssa Block. On Tuesday, we talked with the mayor of Cordova, Alaska, and heard about the unusual amount of snow the city has received. At that point, more than 18 feet this winter. For an update, today we reached Cordova resident Wendy Rainey. She and her husband run the Orca Adventure Lodge on the outskirts of town. She said since Tuesday, there's been more snow than rain, and today, finally, is a beautiful day.
And a beautiful day up here right now is any day without precipitation. So it's very cold. We've switched gears and gone from rain, which we had a majority of yesterday, mixed rain and snow, making everything a big slushy mess, to a freeze last night. And now we're looking at an ice skating rink.
Well, how are you keeping up with the shoveling?
We're actually catching up. We've had hired some folks from town and had a crew digging out here, to the point where yesterday when the National Guard reached us for their list, we turned away the diggers but did accept help with loaders.
Have you put the kids to work with the shovels?
Oh, yeah. We have twin 16-year-old boys that are intimately familiar with shovels right now.
I bet they are. You know, we had read earlier this week that Cordova needed a certain kind of shovel, a scoop shovel that it didn't have, that the shovels they had there just weren't able to keep up with the amount of snow. Is that true?
That's true. Actually, we made a desperate call to a company that comes in here in the winter, and they run a heli-ski operation, and we made a desperate call to them to air freight us some shovels when this all started, and I'm really glad we did that because the shovels were breaking because of the weight of the snow, and once it crusted up and frozen, you can't even use the scoop shovels. It's just too dense to maneuver it.
What are you most worried about right now, Wendy?
Right now, the focus has changed from collapsing buildings to digging out fuel tanks and being able to keep the fuel supplies running so that we can continue to keep buildings heated and we don't get a freeze-up.
And what about the kids? I know school was out earlier this week. What's happening there?
School's been out all week, so they've basically had roughly a month off for Christmas break this year, and I think they're ready to go back. I'm ready for them to go back, but they've been keeping themselves pretty busy.
How unusual is it for school to be closed for so long?
I don't know that they've ever had a snow day that is on record here in Cordova.
A lot
of times, if you live out of town, it's kind of a parental decision. The school will say the buses aren't running. If you want to keep your kids at home, please do. It's parental discretion, but I don't recall a weather day for the schools.
Wendy, how high is the snow piled right now outside your lodge there?
We had a day of wind and rain, so it's actually come down a little bit, but there's still snow piles that are up over 20 feet. In town, they're 20 to 30 feet plus, and it's still, you really have to watch your kids because even though, you know, they're like a magnet for kids, they're not stable and they are dangerous. And if a child fell into the center of a snow pile, it would be like being buried in an avalanche.
Wow. Well, what are you hearing about the forecast? Is there more snow on the way, or are you getting a break?
I think we're getting a break. We're at cold and clear right now, which is, it has its good and bad. You know, the cold and clear makes it very icy and very treacherous to maneuver, but I was digging out my ice spikes from my boots out of the closet this morning, and we'll keep going because this is only the beginning of the winter.
I've been talking with Wendy Rainey, who's co-owner of the Orca Adventure Lodge in Cordova, Alaska. Wendy, hang in there, and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. You guys have a great day.
And this being an election year, there is, of course, a lot to talk about with our regular Friday political commentators, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Welcome back to you both.
Good to be here.
With you.
We're coming off Tuesday's New Hampshire primary, heading toward the South Carolina primary a week from Saturday. Mitt Romney, of course, coasted to victory in South Carolina, coasted to victory in New Hampshire. South Carolina should theoretically not be as friendly a place for him, but his poll numbers have been really strong there. Do you think that holds, David Brooks?
I guess so. I guess the wild card for me is this Bain issue, this issue about Bain Capital. Newt Gingrich, or at least his PAC, released a completely meretricious and demagogic video, which may have some effect. I think Bain Capital, on average, added value to the economy. They had every incentive to really do good for companies in the long run. Nonetheless, I think a lot of people take a look at Wall Street, take a look at financiers, take a look at capitalists who are not people who just start business and stay in place with one product line, but who move from company to company, changing things very radically. I think there could be a level of distrust, and so far the Romney explanation for that has been pretty flat-footed. So that could change things, but right now Romney's still the prohibitive favorite.
EJ?
It's hard to see his losing in South Carolina, and South Carolina is historically actually pretty good for establishment candidates. George W. Bush stopped the McCain rebellion with a pretty vicious campaign back in 2000. But I agree this Bain issue is a real problem, if not now, then later, because one of President Obama's weaknesses has been with white working class voters. And I think the Bain issue and the way private equity works in terms of the part of it that often strips companies of assets or loads companies with debt, a lot of ordinary people look at this and say, this is not a good way to do capitalism. And so I think Romney, as David said, hasn't handled it very well. So I think a lot of working class voters, lower middle class voters, have doubts about Romney today that they didn't have 2 weeks ago.
I want to talk to you about this a bit more, because in his victory speech on Tuesday, Mitt Romney talked about desperate Republicans who he said were chiming in with President Obama on what he called the politics of envy. And the issue here is his time at Bain, also his claim that the talk of economic inequality was fueled by envy. Mitt Romney was asked about that the next day in an interview on the Today Show on NBC. Let's take a listen.
I think it's fine to talk about those things in quiet rooms and discussions about tax policy and the like. But the president has made this part of his campaign rally. Everywhere we go, or he goes, we hear him talking about millionaires and billionaires and executives and Wall Street. And it's a very envy-oriented, attack-oriented approach, and I think it'll fail.
EJ, what about that envy-oriented approach that Mitt Romney's talking about there? We're back to the 1%, aren't we?
I thought that was a terrible answer. It just doesn't look good when a rich guy says anybody who cares about inequality is exhibiting envy. He's accusing a majority of the country, judging from some of the polls showing how much people care about rising inequality, saying a majority is committing this sin of envy. And the other part is that we should discuss this in quiet rooms. I mean, you talk about feeding charges of elitism. It's okay. We want to keep this issue away from the riffraff. I mean, it's he really has handled this very badly so far.
David, do you agree? Bad handling of this issue on Mitt Romney's part?
Quiet rooms. smoke-filled quiet rooms, preferably. You know, I don't think he's handled it well. He said this questioning of his Bain experience is either envy, division, or an attack on capitalism. It's not. It's a legitimate point. There are some, I think most LBO firms and most private equity firms, as I say, do add value. They increase churn. So there are layoffs at the beginning when the private equity firms get involved, as they do lay off people. But the studies show that over the long term, they increase hiring and they increase jobs by making the firms more efficient. Nonetheless, it's legitimate to ask, was Bain doing the good kind of LBO activity, which really does help a company, or were they, getting these dividends by loading these companies with debt? The second issue, which I think Romney has not really begun to address, is business experience a good preparation for political experience? That's not an easy case to make. Historically, it has not been a good correlation. John Corzine was pretty good at Goldman Sachs. I'm not sure he was a great governor in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. So Romney really has to explain that a little more.
And I think his other problem is he made his business experience a centerpiece of his whole campaign. He doesn't want to really talk much about his time as governor of Massachusetts, but he's saying, I'm a business guy so I can create jobs. So he invites us to look at the side of Bain that didn't create jobs and the side of private equity that does sometimes blow up companies, leaving the people in private equity still richer anyway. Those are legitimate questions.
A related question here. Mitt Romney has not released his tax returns that presumably would show how much he made when he was at Bain Capital and also how much he made since he left in the profit-sharing retirement arrangement that he has. Will he have to release those returns, do you think? How potent an issue might this become, David?
Yeah, I've never heard of a case where we've actually learned anything. We might learn that he's rich. I think we know that. He's rich. I think the two issues that are sort of salient are what tax rates is he paying? Private equity guys sometimes pay these very low Warren Buffett-level tax rates, and that might be embarrassing for him. Second, we'll, I guess, learn his charitable deductions. Does he, if he doesn't tithe the way he says he does, that might be an issue. I rarely think learning this stuff actually changes anything.
EJ, do you think he has to release them? Will
I think the pressure on him will grow precisely because the Bain issue has put the question of how did he make his money, what kind of taxes did he pay on the table. And now a lot of Democrats, if he doesn't release them, want to say, well, what is he hiding? This was going to justify those kinds of questions, which he doesn't want Democrats to feel so free to ask.
Last question briefly about a new Gallup survey that shows within the American electorate, conservatives outnumber liberals nearly 2-1. 40% conservative, 21% liberal, 35% say they're moderate. David Brooks, what does that say to you?
Well, we're still a center-right country. If you ask people, what do you fear more, big business or big government, a vast majority fear big government more than big business. It's not true that the Republicans outnumber conservatives 2-1, because a lot of those people who call themselves conservatives are actually Democrats. But it means we're in a country that's still center-right, still basically suspicious of government.
If you ask that question with the word progressive in there instead of conservative, the split is much closer. Conservatives have always outnumbered liberals. A lot of people who say conservative are talking about being old-fashioned family people and have quite liberal views on economic issues. Nonetheless, it's an advantage for the conservatives.
Okay. E.G. Dionne of The Washington Post and Brookings Institution, David Brooks of The New York Times. Thanks to you both. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thank you.
Thank you.